Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 240 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Hello, so first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to part two of episode number 240 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I am Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or on Stitcher, or on iHeartRadio, or on... I'm still trying to figure out how to, you know, migrate my podcast from Google Podcast to YouTube Music. I'm having a little bit of a hard time with that right now. So, but I still got some time to migrate my my show to Google to YouTube Music. So, if you're an Android user, just find me on Spotify for now. Download Spotify; it's a free app. Find me on there. You know, the Millennial Throwback Machine. That's my podcast. Find me on there for now because YouTube Music is I'm having a little hard time. I agree with my podcast from Google Podcast and YouTube Music, but hopefully I'll get that figured out soon. But yeah, so on, you know, Spotify or iHeartRadio or on Stitcher, and you're wondering, so what the heck is, let me give you a description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 28-year-old songwriter / producer, but I'm also a 60 music fan / expert / nerd, and easy to do this podcast. I take one song by one artist of the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part, I'll talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, into my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chorus, million lyrics. And second part, I'll dig deep into the history behind the track. In that part, I'll talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, talk about the songwriters who wrote the song and produced it, that produced it, and the peak condition of the song, Miranda Bergerly and Billboard Hot 100 charts for which came out, talk about the session players play on the song, also songwriters who wrote it, and the studio song was recorded at, and the history behind the artists that wrote the song and the songwriters that wrote it, and the history behind the label the song was released on, and the year month the song was released. All that is in the second part of this show. Now, before we move on this week's episode of this podcast, a couple things. I think I may have already talked about this before on one particular episode, but just in case you guys don't know already, I have brand new merch available for the premium subscription version of this podcast. Yes, I have a brand new merch store with the slogan Fly on the Wall Stories. If you haven't seen it yet, I did buy a t-shirt recently. It's on my Instagram and on my TikTok, and you'll be able to find videos of displaying the shirt. The new shirt, Flying the Wall, with the slogan Flying the Wall Stories, with the name and podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine Premium on the bottom. Guys, this slogan perfectly represents exactly what you're getting with the premium subscription version of this podcast, which is Flying the Wall Stories from people that were there, people who were alive back in the 60s and making records back then, and the real inside scoop on all those records that you may or may not be familiar with, but you know, it's the real deal. It's the real stories behind the songs. Some of the greatest records ever made from the 60s, from the people that were there who were alive and making that music back then. But yeah, so and guys, I've been, you know, it's crazy. This month has been so busy with interview episodes. I did 5 interview episodes, and in the 3 out of the 5 of them, I would check this out. So I did 3 interviews, but then I had some additional questions that I wanted to ask the people in one interview that I didn't get a chance to ask. So guess what? I called them back and I got some additional, information for each one that each 3 out of the 5 that I did this month, which is really, really cool. Awesome. A lot of really good stories that I got from these interviews. Very, very excited to release these interviews because they're really, really cool. And hopefully I'll be doing more soon, but damn, 5 in one month, that's the most I've done in one month in quite some time. Usually I just do 1 a month, but I did 5 this month. I mean, wow, I'm going to have at least 1 a month every month for a while going into 2025, which is crazy. you know, so anyways, yeah, so that's, and I got some more coming out, this year, some interviews I did recently. I just put out one with Charlotte Ingwe, an original member of Soul Survivors. And, I also just put out one with two original guys from New Colony 6. So yeah, so that's been keeping me busy lately. That's why I haven't really done, put out any free episodes, cause I'm, you know, I'm really busy doing interviews lately for the pre-inscription version of my podcast. And, yeah, and just, you know, finding the time to do this free version and also, you know, doing interviews, it's tough. You know, I've been doing a lot of interviews lately, guys, and, it's been crazy, but, you know, that's why I think you guys should sign up for the premium version of the podcast. That way you guys don't miss out on these, all these great stories about some of the greatest music ever written and recorded. You know, so please go sign up for that. The link to that is in the description of this episode's podcast. And please check out my new merch, too, for the Fly on the Wall Stories, the new Red Bull merch store for the premium version's podcast. I really want you guys to look at it and let me know your thoughts on the new logo. I think the logo is great. I really like it. I'm really satisfied with it. But, yeah, so hope you guys are doing well. I'll try to, you know, I'm trying to see for this particular version of my podcast, maybe I could do, you know, focus on artists that have passed away or, you know, nobody worked on the record is still alive, so I can't really interview them, you know, to kind of focus on those types of records. And Dusty Springfield is definitely one of those artists because the producer has passed away. A lot of musicians work with her passed away, you know, so, you know, but anyways, so, yeah, this week I'm going to dive into the history behind her song. The last song I did on my podcast is You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And I'm going to talk about the history behind Dusty Springfield. But I also want to tell you guys, I'm still working on my music. You know, I'm still working on the three new songs. I'm actually gearing up to play another show soon, a couple weeks, on April 13th at Lounge 151 in Midland Hills. I'm really excited to play that show. It's going to be a good time. I'll keep you guys, you know, keep you guys posted what time I'm on. But if you're in LA, come out and see me. I really appreciate it if you can come out. We celebrate, and also, guys, I just got my first placement. I literally got my first placement in a TV show. Not in a TV show, but I'm finally gonna earn some money for my original music, which I'm really, really excited about. It's amazing. Oh my god, it's so good. I finally got my first placement, which is awesome. You know, and hopefully I'll get more soon, and I hope the payout for this placement is pretty small, but hey, you know what? It's just the beginning. It's just a start. I'm eventually going to get more placements. I'm going to make more money. So off my music, which I'm really, really excited about. That's been like a dream of mine for so long, is to make some money for my music. I'm so happy it's finally happening, and hopefully I'll get more placements soon. I'll make a lot more money for my music, which I'm really excited about. Hopefully that happens soon. It is so cool. I finally achieved that. I'm going to cry when I get that royalty check in the mail. It's going to be so cool. Anyways, guys, so that's really cool. And all these interviews I'm doing, it's all really great. And let's get started in this week's show. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's artist, which is Dusty Springfield. Now, the thing I want you guys to know about Dusty Springfield is that I feel like all artists that, you know, in the music industry struggle with something called artist identity. And what I mean by that is, artist identity is their own signature style, their own, you know, what makes them them and what makes them different from everybody else. And in sometimes certain artists, they want to get a specific kind of sound for their music, but because of where they are and the circumstances that they're in their life, it's difficult for them to get that sound for whatever reason. And Dusty Springfield is a good example of someone who, for a very brief period of time, struggled with her artist identity. She didn't really know what kind of sound she wanted for her music yet. But, you know, it's funny, you know, when it comes to like British music from the 60s, some of it sounded, a lot of British music from the 60s sounded very British. I mean, you're talking like the New Vaudeville Band and, the Hermits and, you know, Mrs. Brown, You Got a Lovely Daughter, and, you know, that sort of thing, and, you know, I'm Henry VIII, and, you know, there's a lot of British music from the 60s. It sounded pretty British. I mean, even the Beatles, like When I'm 64, you know, songs like that, you know, that just have a very British sound to them, that British music hall kind of a thing. But there were a lot of British from the 60s. I've talked about this before on my podcast, guys. There's a lot of British music that sounded pretty freaking American, like not British sounding at all. And there were a lot of, British musicians at the time who could care less about, you know, the British heritage. And what they were the craziest about was the American stuff. They wanted to sound like the American artists. And that's what they were clinging on to, whether it was the blues or the R&B or the soul or the girl group. They wanted to cling on to that American sound, and they had no interest in sounding very, very British. I mean, Stones are a great example of that. The Stones are really, they were big R&B soul fans, and they were huge blues freaks. In fact, they named their band after a Muddy Waters song called Rolling Stone. So I think it was called Rolling Stone Blues. And, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, a lot of British bands didn't have a lot of interest in their own heritage and trying to sound British. A lot of them were trying to sound American. And Dusty Springfield is a great example of that. Because in the beginning, well, let me just give you guys some background. She was born Mary Isabel Catherine O'Brien. That was her real name. And she was born in West Hampstead, England. And, you know, her parents were Irish. You know, that's why she has the last name O'Brien. And she got her start in the music industry. Well, you know, like all people of her generation, she grew up listening to all the great American songbook, artists and groups, and, you know, the big band like Artie Shaw, you know, and Benny Goodman, and, you know, Glenn Miller and Duke Ellington and all that stuff, all the Irving Berlin, all the great, you know, Cole Porter, all those songs from Tin Pan Alley, and just, you know, that sort of big band jazz pop from the 30s and 40s. That's what she grew up listening to when it was new, you know. And then, but by the mid 50s, you had the rock and roll generation that came to be with, you know, Elvis and Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and that kind of music. And, you know, at the time, I don't think she was really taken in with that sound quite yet. Because the first group that she was in, which was called the Springfields, with her brother Tom, and it's interesting. I'm not exactly sure how she got the name, Dusty Springfield, but I do know that she did change her name from Mary Isabel Catherine O'Brien to Dusty Springfield, and that's how she got her name, right? And it's really interesting. When she changed her name to Dusty Springfield, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm not exactly sure where she got that name, but, she decided to, you know, call herself that. And, she was originally, in 1957, she decided to call herself, joined a group called Lana Sisters and with Irish Chris Long and Riss Lana and Lynn Abrams, and, you know, and basically they weren't actual sisters, but she dropped the stage name Shane Lana and cut her hair, lost a glass experiment in makeup fashion to become one of the sisters. And then in 1960, she left the Lana Sisters, and then she joined the Springfields. And basically they had two guys in the group, Rashad Fylde and Mike Hurst, and then Mike Hurst changed his name to Tim Springfield, and then became Dusty, Tom, and Tim Springfield. That's the group that they became. But her original name was Mary Isabel Catherine O'Brien, she was given the nickname Dusty because she used to play football with the boys in the street, and she was described as a tomboy, so that's how she got the name Springfield, which is really, really interesting. Her father, you know, who had been raised in British India, worked as a tax accountant and consultant, and that's where her father was originally from, you know, that, you know, so anyways, you know, she grew up in High Wycombe, Buckinghamshire until the early 50s, and later lived in Ealing in West London. And she went to St. Anne's Convert School in Northfield, a non-traditional all-girls school. And it's interesting. So, she definitely had this tomboy aspect of herself. And, you know, you wouldn't know about this until years and years later, but she actually came out as gay. She was a queer artist, but I think at the time she was in the closet. I don't think she was openly gay. She was a queer artist, and nobody really knew that at the time, but it's true. And the Springfields were a folk group, right? And that's how they got started. And, you know, they actually got to tour in America in the early 60s because they actually managed to have a top 40 hit, you know, a little bit before the Beatles actually as a group in 1962, a song called Silver Threads and Golden Needles, which I believe was originally recorded by Wanda Jackson. Wanda Jackson was the first group to record, she was the first artist to record Silver Threads and Golden Needles. And then it was covered by the Springfields, and they covered it and they did a pretty kick-ass version of that song. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's got a really cool banjo part, a really cool electric guitar solo in it. It's a really, really great version. And Ivor Ramone produced that version, in 1962 is when they got signed to Philips Records, and Ivor Ramone produced them. And Ivor Ramone recorded them at Philips Studios in England, and that's where they cut Silver Threads and Golden Needles. Now at the time, this is what I'm talking about with her struggling with artist identity. So time she didn't quite know exactly what kind of sound she wanted to go for, and then she when the Springfields were on tour in like 1962-63, Dusty Springfield heard Tell Him by the Exciters, and when she was in New York. And when she heard that record, she was like, you know what? This is what I want to do. Screw folk music. I want to be an R&B solo artist. This is my bag. This is what I want to do. So, with that being said, since they couldn't really have another hit after Silver Threads and Golden Needles, they struggled to have more success after that. And definitely in America. But they had two big hits in England. Island of Dreams and Say I Won't Be There, but they struggled to have any more hits after that. And then October 1963, she left the group, and then her brother Tom became a songwriter for the Seekers. You know, I'll Never Find Another You, Georgie Girl, The Carnival Is Over, those songs. You know, he became a songwriter for the Seekers, and you know, which is a total folk, you know, pop group in the style of Peter Paul and Mary. So it's interesting. He delved deeper in the folk pop genre, whereas Dusty Springfield was trying to break away from that. And, you know, Dusty Springfield at the time, she was a huge Brill Building freak. She loved Brill Building pop music. I'm talking the Crystals. I'm talking the Ronettes. I'm talking, that whole thing, Leslie Gore, you know, the Chiffons, the Shirelles, all that music. She was a big fan of that whole sound. And it's evident in her first hit that she recorded as a solo artist, I Only Want to Be With You, which came out in early 1964. It was recorded late 1963, but then it came out in early 1964, and it just blew up. I mean, it was her first big hit in England, but also in America too. It was a huge hit in America, and it established her as a solo artist. And that was recorded at Philips Studios in England. But if you listen to the song Only Want to Be With You, it's got a very American sound to it. It's got the horns, it's got the string arrangement, and it's got, like, you know, very New York sound to it. Could have been arranged by Gary Sherman, recorded at Bell Sound Studios in New York with all the usual suspects like Gary Chester, you know, and Bill Syker and Russ Vegas and all those guys. But no, it was cut in England with English session players. You know, I'm talking Bobby Graham, I'm talking Big Jim Sullivan, I'm talking Jimmy Page, you know, all those people, all those British studio musicians, they all played on it, and it was a very, very big hit for Dusty. You know, it was like, and at the time, Jimmy Page was a studio musician. He wasn't like, you know, a member of Led Zeppelin yet. He was just a very, very busy studio musician. And by the way, the Breakaways were the background vocalists on that song, and they played. They actually sang with Dusty Springfield on a lot of her records, and Keith Grant was the engineer for that song. It was actually recorded at Olympic Studios in London, and arranged and conducted by Ivor Ramone. And for some reason, I thought it was cut at Philips Studios, but I think she recorded at Philips Studios a little bit later on. I'm pretty sure she did, because that's where she got "You Don't Have to Say You Love Me," and you know, and it was again very, very Phil Spector kind of a thing. Crystal's Ronettes, that the whole nine yards with that song, and you know, the horn section definitely had that sound of like Leslie Gore and songs like that. And you know, this is an English record. This was an American record. This was an English record. This was a cut in a foreign country. But the fact that she really wanted to sound American and she wasn't really embracing her English roots, there's something to be said about that. She really wanted to have that American sound, even though she was from England and recording in England. So there's really something to be said about that. But anyways, let's talk about a little bit more about her history. And I should probably talk about Philips Records too, just so that way, if you guys don't know anything about Philips Records, Philips was a division of Mercury Records. And Philips was the international version of Mercury Records, right? It was two companies. Mercury was the American record company, and Philips was the international record company. And they both were pretty much the same record company. Philips covered the international world, other countries besides America, and Mercury was the American record company. If you were on Mercury Records, then you got, oftentimes you got international distribution on Philips, but there were also a lot of artists that were on Philips, that got distributed in America, like for the Four Seasons, for instance, Frankie Valli, the Four Seasons. They actually wound up on Philips Records, and that's how they got American distribution, actually international distribution. They got international distribution from being on Philips Records, but also you have to keep in mind it was literally this part one of the same company of Mercury Records. It was just Philips was the international division of Mercury Records. And that's the thing. So, this was before Spotify, before Apple Music, because, you know, streaming nowadays with streaming, we have worldwide music distribution at our fingertips, right? All we have to do is just upload our artwork and our songs, in our masters, and the credits to DistroKid, and you know, you can let DistroKid know when we want to release our songs, and then you know it'll get distributed worldwide on one particular day. You know, that's just how it is with the internet these days. But back then there was no DistroKid or, you know, digital aggregator like we have now with even the other ones like, you know, TuneCore and CD Baby. Those didn't exist. I mean, you know, how records got in the hands of, you know, the American public were from the record companies. The record companies work with different distributors and different vinyl pressing plants to get records inside the stores and for people to purchase records, you know, like 45 RPMs and LPs. The record companies back then were like the DistroKids, the CD Babies, and the TuneCores of today, the digital aggregators of today. Back then there were the record companies like Motown, RCA, Columbia, Atlantic. You know, they were the record companies back then were pretty much the digital distributors of today that independent artists use. So yeah, I mean, and a lot of times back then, in order for a single to break out and internationally, an American record company had to find an international record company to distribute the artists over there. And a lot of times, certain American record companies didn't have strong enough international distribution in other countries. So because of this, a lot of American artists had a tough time having hits in other countries and vice versa. I mean, the American record companies at the time had the strongest international distribution included Columbia and RCA Records. They had the strongest international distribution at the time, and they really had a lot of success, you know, getting having hits worldwide because they had stronger international distribution at that point. And you know, like I said, Mercury was the American record company. Philips was the international record company, and sometimes, you know, Philips International Records distributed in America under the same record company name. And Dusty Springfield is a great example of one of those artists that was able to get American distribution under the Philips name. You know, so that's how you heard, like, like, for example, the Beatles were on Capitol out here in America. They were on Parlophone. You know, that's just how it worked. I mean, you know, a lot of times an English artist would be on one label out here, and then they would be on a completely different label in the UK. Like, for example, Hermits and Dave Clark 5 were all in Columbia, UK. Has nothing to do with Columbia Records. Columbia was a division of Parlophone Records. They were on Columbia in the UK. And the Dave Clark 5 were on Epic, and then which is a division of Columbia Records. In the subsidiary Columbia Records, and Hermits Herbs are on MGM, and also Animals were on MGM Records out here, but they were in America, but in England they were on Columbia. So, that's just how it was back then. I mean, like I said, guys, this is before Spotify, before Apple Music. So in order for these English record companies to get their songs distributed in America, they had to find an American record company to distribute their artists. A lot of times, you know, and sometimes they got lucky and their English artists would be on the same American America like Dusty Springfield. But that's just how it worked back then. I mean, the Searchers were on Cap Records in America, but in England they were on Pi, you know, and Petula Clark was on Warner Brothers in America, but in England she was on Pi, you know. So oftentimes, you know, the English kids would get the same songs, oftentimes the same songs, just on a different record company. And a lot of times, the English releases were different than the American releases. Certain songs were released as singles in the UK only, but not in America. Gene Penny had a lot of hit records that only were released as singles in the UK, and they were not released as singles in America. So they were only hits in the UK, and they were not hits in America. So a lot of times, and of course, the Beatles, you know, almost all their albums had different versions for the UK release and the American release. I mean, there was a different track listing for a lot of their albums, had different songs listed, printed for available for the American version and the English version. So that did happen a lot. A lot of times, you know, the English kids got different B-side. And then the American kids on for a lot of the 45s released. The point I'm trying to make here is that before Spotify, Apple, before universal worldwide digital music distribution, like what we have now with the streaming services, you know, a lot of times the English kid, the foreign kids and the American kids oftentimes got different, songs released as singles or different cuts on albums. For the artists that they love listening to, they didn't always get the same releases in both countries. And some songs are only released as singles in Australia and certain parts of the world, in France and other parts of the world, but the songs did not come out as singles in America, you know. But definitely Columbia and RCA had the strongest international distribution at that point in the 60s. They were able to get you pretty big hits in other parts of the world. But nowadays you just have worldwide digital music distribution, like, you know, DistroKid, TuneCore, CD Baby. But back then, Union Record companies who had pretty strong, physical distribution in other parts of the world, and Columbia, RCA by far had the strongest, international music distribution at that point. And I think that they, RCA probably had the strongest because there are a lot of RCA records that were hits in other parts of the world, as well as hits out here, you know, so. And in fact, they got a lot of exposure for certain artists who were international, who weren't even foreign, like like Master Jack, Four Jacks and Jill, that was they were a group of South Africa, and they managed to get them, you know, success in America with Master Jack, you know. So that's one thing. So one thing I'll say about Dusty Springfield is that Dusty was one of those artists that really wanted to record in America really, really badly. In the early days of her career, she did record in America. I mean, some of her parts of her album were recorded in New York, with Gary Sherman arranging and Ray Stevens arranging her songs. So she did record some of her stuff early on in New York, but the success for her material wasn't exactly like on point, like all the time. She didn't always have commercial success, in America at that point. Sometimes she struggled to have hits in America, but some of her early stuff, like her second album, certain tracks are recorded in New York with Ray Stevens as her arranger and Shelby Singleton Jr. as her producer, you know. And Shelby, by the way, Shelby Singleton was the president of Mercury Records. And by the way, like what I just said, Mercury and Philips were one of the same record company. They were basically a division of Mercury Records, you know. So they were part of the same record company. I think they were initially separate from Mercury at that point. I think they were, they had Fontana Records, but which is a subsidiary of theirs. I think they were originally part of Columbia Records. That was their original record company that distributed them, but then they lost their distribution deal with US and Canada from Columbia. And that's when they basically joined up with Mercury Records, and they became one of the many labels for Mercury Records, and they became basically part of the Mercury Records family, if that makes any sense. But yeah, so they were, again, like I said, like, you know, early on, she wanted to record in New York, and she wanted that American sound. She really, really did, guys. It was one of those things. She desperately wanted that American sound. You know, she really, really wanted it. Because her favorite records were the Brill Building New York sessions. You know, she wanted to record songs by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. She wanted to record, you know, Man and Wild songs. She really, really wanted to spread her wings and really, really record a lot of, American records, you know. In fact, Guess Who, which is Gary Klein, Artie Cornfield, that was a New York record. Ted Darrell and Chip Taylor, I mean, they were writers for April Blackwood Music, which is a publishing company based in, I believe, 1619 Broadway. I think it was 1619. Might have been 1650. I think it was 1619, actually. So they were writers for April Blackwood Music. So she really wanted to dive into the American Brill Building sound. She really, really wanted to do that. And like I said, you know, Shelby Singleton was her American producer. But she mostly recorded most of her stuff in the UK. Ivor Ramon was her main producer at that point, and Johnny Franz was also her producer. So it was Johnny Franz and Ivor Ramon. I think Ivor Ramon was an arranger, and Johnny Franz was a producer. But you know, they were a team. They really worked on her records very diligently, and like I said, they recorded. That album that You Don't Have to Say You Love Me on, that was recorded in Philips Studios, actually. That was her first time recording in Philips Studios. But I Only Want to Be With You was recorded at Olympic Studios, which was an independent studio and had no tie to the record company. Philips Studios was a studio owned by Philips Records, and that was in Stanpole, London. And Olympic Studios was on Canton Street in London. But Philips Studios was in Stanpole, Stanhope Place, London. But yeah, so anyways, let's get into the history behind You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Okay, so this was, I believe, her third big hit in America, because she, at the time, she had had I Only Want to Be With You and Wishin' Open. Wishin' Open was actually written by Burt Bacharach and Al David. They first did it with Dionne Warwick, and she did it as an album cut in on, I believe, the album Make Way for Dionne Warwick in 1964. She did it as an album cut, but it never came out as a single, so never was a hit for her. So Burt Bacharach and Hal David flew to England and actually recorded, you know, Wishin' Hope with Dionne Warwick and had the Breakaway singing on it. And I believe it was an Olympic session, because I actually take that back. So a lot of the early stuff was recorded at Olympic Studios, but then she started recording at Philips Studios. You know, starting with You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. So Burt Bacharach and Hal David flew out to England and recorded that song with her, and it was released as a single both in England and in America, and it became a huge hit for her. And You Don't Have to Say You Love Me was actually her third hit in America. Now, just so you know, guys, you know, she was really craving that American sound, and she wasn't... You know, and she, the other thing about Dusty is that she was an absolute 100% perfectionist. She wanted everything to be done absolutely 100% perfect. I mean, you know, she just, you know, she, a lot of times she was just very frustrated in the studio. She was never satisfied with the songs that was getting pitched to her and the material she was and her takes in the studio. You know, but the interesting thing about You Don't Have to Say You Love Me is that it was originally an Italian song. And it was an Italian song that with Italian lyrics, and the melody was Italian, but the song was originally written with Italian lyrics, and it was one of those songs that was submitted in the Eurovision Song Contest, and the original writers for the Italian song, it was Pino Donaggio and Vito Pallavicini. So those are the writers of the Italian song. It's Uchi no vivo senza te. I hope I did a good job of pronouncing that. You know, that was the original Italian lyric. You can kind of hear it. Uchi no vivo senza te. I mean, you can kind of hear, you don't have to say you love me. You can kind of hear that sort of pronunciation there. But yeah, I believe it was submitted in the Eurovision Song Contest. If it wasn't, you know, my apologies if I got that wrong, but it was recorded by Donaggio, and it was number one hit in Italy in March 1965. And it was actually for a movie that came, that Lucio Visconti film called La Stare del Dolorosa. Again, I'm terrible at pronouncing these names, but it was submitted for as awarded the Golden Lion, the Venice Film Festival that September in 1965, Dusty Springfield was at that festival when Donaggio and Miller performed. So the song was co-written by their team partner Jody Miller, and that's where Donaggio and Miller performed the song "Lo che non vivo senza te," and she didn't know the main lyrics of the song, so she didn't understand what she was talking about. But she was really moved to tears, and she wanted to record the song. She was a big fan of it, so she got an acetate of the song which was Donaggio's. And she let a year go by before she decided, you know what, I think I'm going to record this. And it was actually her managers who wrote the English lyrics to the song. It was her friends, Vicky Wickham and Simon Napier Bell, Simon Napier Bell managed the Yardbirds, and her friend Vicky Wickham actually wrote the lyrics. And they didn't really have that much experience as songwriters, but this is kind of how the song was written. So they heard the melody from Donaggio's song, and they decided, you know, let's write English lyrics for the song. Let's see how this goes. So they went back to Vicky Wickham's flat and started working on it. And they wanted to go to a training disco. So we had about an hour to write it. And then they wrote the chorus, and they wrote the verse and taxi to wherever we were going. So the song was pretty much written pretty quickly. And originally the lyric started out as "I don't love you," and then they said, "You know what? Let's not write a song called 'I Don't Love You.' That doesn't sound great." And then why don't we call it "You Don't Love Me"? And then eventually "You Don't Love Me" turned "You Don't Have to Love Me." And then finally they came up with the lyric, "You don't have to say you love me," and it was a phrasing that really fit the song's melody. And Napier Bell gave the same, and actually named his autobiography after that. You don't have to say you love me. That's they named the autobiography that. And you know what's crazy? And this is something. This is proof that Dusty was never really satisfied with her vocal performances. She had a really hard. She was very. Very much perfectionist in the studio. She was a control freak, kind of like Burt Bacharach was. So she originally was going to record this in the vocal group at Philips Studios in Stanpole. So she was in the booth cutting vocals for the song, right? And essentially what happened was that she wasn't really happy with the acoustics. And then she moved to in the booth. And then she went to a stairwell, and she recorded the vocals of the song in a stairwell. And then she did 47 takes of the vocal, which is fucking crazy. She did 47 takes of this vocal. Can you imagine singing the song over and over and over again? It's just a monster of a record. It's just, oh my god, it is so huge sounding. Oh my god, so crazy. But anyway, so they did 47 takes of the lead vocal. And like I said, Johnny Franz produced it, Ivan Ramon arranged it, and that was sort of the team, you know, Johnny Franz, Ivan Ramon sort of working on these songs for Dusty. And it was just, and this is what her career was like for a while. But like I said, you know, she really wasn't happy with the American R&B soul sound in England was tough with English studio musicians and the English recording techniques at that time. She wanted that groovy, that groovy, funky American, playing of the Funk Brothers, and she actually was a fan of Motown. She actually did a good job of bringing the awareness of the Motown sound to America, and she organized a whole English tour for the Motown artists, including Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, the Four Tops, and the Temptations, and the Supremes, and Smokey Robinson, Miracle. She brought all those artists to America along with the Funk Brothers. So as you can see, she was a huge fan of the American sound, the American R&B soul sound. That was her bag. That's what she wanted to sound like. And it could be, you know, wrong record company, because maybe they just couldn't get that sound in England. They really couldn't. And a lot of her mid-60s singles flop, like In the Middle of Nowhere and Little, and You Gotta Give Me Some of Your Lovin'. She had a tough time, having success in America at that point. She had 3 hits at this point in America, I Only Want to Be With You. Stay a While actually did okay. I think it beat number 39, the follow-up single to Only Want to Be With You. It did okay. It was actually not that bad. So that was interesting. But then she had Wish and Hope, and pretty big hit for her. Burt Bacharach and Al Davis wrote the song, and they produced it too. I believe they did. They went to the studio and produced this with her with Dusty. They flew out to England to work with her. And then she had You Don't Have to Say Love Me, but that was it for a while. Like she was having a tough time, getting hits for herself, and she eventually said goodbye to the Phillips Bark Company, but not before having a few more hits. She actually recorded an American song which did pretty well, called a song called "I'll Try Anything," which was first recorded. I think she did pretty well with that song, and it was done in America, in an American recording studio in New York at the time. And Mark Barkin wrote the song, and it was not that big of a hit of hers, but it did pretty well, and I believe it was recorded at CBS Recording Studios in New York, and again I think she did about a bunch of different, versions of that song, and so the song was written by Mark Barker, who originally had on my podcast a while ago, You know, and basically, Mark Barkin had Ellie Greenwich sing on the original demo of the song, and it was recorded first at in December 1966 at CBS Studios. Herb Bernstein arranging the song, and then basically and then they yield the complete master of "I'll Try Anything," on January 22nd. At CBS Recording Studios, and she actually in Springfield, she herself will actually look to have the master's rhythm track and use the basis of new recording the song, done at Philips Studios in London. So, it's one of those things where it's like, the song, ever since her song "Only Want to Be with You," she tried to go for more of a softer sound. Like, "You Don't Have to Say You Love Me," but when she recorded "All Try Anything," that was her return of her big, American drum sound with those big sounding drums that she used, on all those records that she did, kind of like the British Invasion, more importantly, the American sound of, like, Gary Chester on drums, the big, timpani, the percussion that they use on those records, like George Devins and stuff like that. So, again, she really wanted to sound American. She didn't want to sound English at all. Her thing was like, "I want to have that American sound," and she eventually divorced from her record company, Philips, and went over to Atlantic Records and, recorded "Destiny in Memphis," in Memphis, which is like the soul capital of the world at that point. She recorded American sound studios in Memphis with all the Memphis, the American boys, Tommy Cogbill on bass, Mike Leach on bass, Reggie Young on guitar, and Bobby Woods, Mike Emmons on keys, and Gene Christian on drums, and the Memphis horns, and Sweet Inspirations, the whole nine yards. And, she recorded "Dusty Memphis" in Memphis. So it was sort of like, by that point, she was really married to having that American sound and wanting to sound soulful and wanting to have that real kind of Aretha Franklin kind of a feel to her music. And, of course, that returned to her the charts of "Son of a Preacher." I mean, even though "Look of Love" did pretty well, and that was one of her last hits recorded at Philips Studios, in England, the theme for Casino Royale, the James Bond movie. And, again, Burt Bacharach and Hal David wrote the song. I believe it was done as an instrumental first and then covered by Dusty Springfield as a vocal version to become a pretty big hit for her. But at that point, she was in Atlantic. She was the backing tracks were in American studios, but then I believe that she went to New York and recut the vocals there because, she was a little nervous about recording in Atlantic Studios in New York. She was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I'm recording in the same studios as Aretha Franklin and all that stuff." I mean, she was like, she was really, really nervous about doing that. She was just like, "Oh my God, I can't believe that I'm recording in the same studios." It was just like, as Aretha Franklin and all those people, I was like, wow. I mean, she was really, really kind of like, whoa, this is kind of crazy. It was just like, and also here's something kind of cool. So, when she got signed to Atlantic Records in November 1968, she suggested that, "Hey, why don't you guys sign this brand new band that it's coming up right now?" And, and then she was like, "Hey, you guys should sign this group." And this group is a brand new group. I think you guys should sign it. And they sound pretty good. They're a real heavy rock band. They're real turn heavy, real kind of new sound, really, really heavy rock. And of course it was Led Zeppelin with John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page. And, those guys had previously backed up Dusty in the recording studio in England. And, they just formed a new band called Led Zeppelin. The way Dusty Memphis was recorded is that, the tracks were done in Memphis, but then she just did the vocals in New York, just by herself, she basically had pretty much outside producers working with her, Jerry Wexler, Reef Martin, Tom Dowd. They were producing her in the studio at Atlantic. And she actually self-produced a lot of her early stuff, like all the stuff on Phillips. And even though Johnny France and Ivor Ramone were the credited producers, she actually produced a lot of those sessions herself, but she never got credit for it. The credit went to Johnny France and Ivor Ramone. So that was a big deal for her. And then after she recorded Destiny in Memphis, she did an album in Philadelphia with MFSB and Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. And she recorded with those musicians. I'm talking like Norman Harris, Bobby Eli, Vinnie Montana, Ronnie Baker, Earl Young, those guys. She actually did an album with them, Ronald Chambers and Eugene Dozer, Don Rinaldo, and all those musicians. She recorded at Sigma Sound Studios in Philadelphia. So she was really stepping in the R&B thing big time. In fact, the hit single from the album, which is a song called "The Brand New Me," that was originally recorded by Jerry Butler first, and then Jerry Butler was like, "Hey, this song's not doing anything for me. Why don't you record it?" So Dusty Springfield sang on top of his original recording of the song. That's pretty fucking cool that she did that. So yes, that's really cool. So she actually recorded a song that was first done by Jerry Butler, and also she wanted to record it in a mountain high enough, but Asher and Simpson didn't let her. They were like, "We're gonna save this for when we get signed to Motown as songwriters," and then that's when they recorded it with Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell. She wanted to record it in a mountain high enough, but Asherton turned it down. So then we're gonna save this for when we record with Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell. And also our background singer also recorded "I'm Gonna Make You Love Me," Madeline Bell. Who sang background on a lot of her sessions, it's possible that "I'm Gonna Make You Love Me," she did an earlier version of that, but I believe that Madeline Bell was one of the first people to record that. I don't think that it may have been offered to Dusty Springfield. I think she did pass on it. She did pass on it, and Madeline Bell did record it, and she became one of her regular background singers at that point. But yeah, so hope you guys. And also, years and years later, she did pass away of cancer, Dusty Springfield, and she hid away from. The public eye for a while, but she did have cancer, and she did pass away from it. It was very, very unfortunate for her that she died so early. She just kind of struggled kind of like in the 70s, but she did pass away of cancer. And it was breast cancer, actually, and that's, but a lot of people paid tribute to her during her funeral, including Elton John, who was at her funeral and did something very, very special for her, at her funeral. So a lot of people were loved her. She thought she was a really, really good musician and a really, really good singer, and that includes this week's episode. An important thing to remember about Dusty Springfield, I think, is that she really had two personalities, right? She was either Mary Catherine O'Brien, which was her real name, right? Mary O'Brien, or she was Dusty Springfield, and the Dusty Springfield, even though on TV and in performance, she was very confident. She had a lot of insecurities. She was, of course, like a lot of other musicians, she battled addiction to drugs and alcohol, and she really had a lot of severe mental health issues. She really wanted to harm herself a lot, and she really felt like, man, I really can't, tell people that I'm queer, because otherwise, I might lose my career as a musician. And she unfortunately had, you know, issues of being, you know, of you know, being, feeling like, man, I can't go, you know, come out as lesbian, because otherwise if I do, like, you know, I'm going to get humiliated. And of course, now it's a very, very different time, or we are way more accepting of lesbians now than they were in the past. And actually, she actually sang background for Elton John album called this 1971 album, Tell Me Connection, which is a pretty big hit. And Jeff Berry produced some songs for her. And, you know, and but the, for an album that never came out. It's very true. You know, he did record an album with Jesse Springfield. And she sang a theme for $6 Million Man, and the Pep Shop Boys invited her to sing a duet with What Have I Done and Deserves This. And Neil Tennant was the lead singer of Pep Shop Boys, actually considered Dusty Memphis one of his favorite albums, so that's really cool. And she recorded it with BJ Thomas, As Long As We Got Each Other, and it was opening theme for the show Growing Pains, which was on from 1989. And, you know, she that was really cool. And then she was, of course, diagnosed with breast cancer. And first it was in remission, and then it came back. And then she passed away not too long after that. And, you know, the Pep Shop Boys were at her funeral, so were Lucas, Elvis Costello, and Lulu. So that was really, really cool. And, yeah, so, hope you guys enjoyed my talk about Dusty Springfield. She had a very complicated personality. She was a total perfectionist. You know, and like I said, she had a hard time accepting, when she felt like she had a hard time figuring out, okay, I've nailed it. I got the perfect take. I got something I could live with, when it came to recording her songs, because she was just a, you know, real perfectionist, you know, and she had a hard time accepting when she had something she could live with when she was recording in the studio. You know, because she was unhappy a lot when she was recording her songs, you know, so. But yeah, so that concludes part two of episode number 240 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I am Sam Williams, and if you learned some fascinating facts about Dusty Springfield, and you didn't really know too much about her, and you're around my age, and you're a millennial / Gen Z, definitely email me at samltwilliaicloud.com. You can also follow me and reach out to me on Instagram and TikTok at iHeartOldies. Now, please, do check out, the things that are in the text description episode of this podcast. That includes the pre-inscription version of this podcast. And it's so cool, guys. I did 5 interviews this month, and three out of the interviews I did, I got to call the person back, and I got some additional information. So that was really, really cool. You know, and that was for Beverly Lee, and that was for Jim Yester, and that was also for what's his name? Al Caesar Berry from the Times. But yeah, so that's really, really cool. And I also interviewed Peggy Santiglia Recker, and as well as I also interviewed Sandy Aguna from Jane the American. So I did all those this month, and those will all come out next year. But I just about interviewed Charlie Ingwe, original member of Soul Survivors. Next month I'm going to have original member of The Vogue, Chuck Blasco, come out, and that interview is going to be really cool. Lots of cool stories in there. But yeah, so please go check out those interviews. The link to that is in the text description of this podcast. But yeah, so I really, really appreciate if you guys could sign up for the premium subscription versions podcast. That way you don't miss any of these interview episodes. And of course, you can check out the official Red Bull merch store for this podcast. Here you'll be able to find all these really, really cool, merch. And I got 2 stores now. I got the Keep Things Groovy store, and I got the Fly in the Wall Story store for the premium versions podcast. I think I can only fit in 1 link, so for now, check out the Fly in the Wall Stories store, and then later on I'll put in the premium version of this podcast. The free version, the free merch, the Keep Things Groovy merch. But yeah, also check out my music, guys. Also with New and Imagined Things. I love that EP. It's really, really good. I'm praying one of the songs will get placed one of these days. The song that I got placed wasn't an old soul. One of the songs off that EP was off on the previous EP, which was Turquoise Apricot. It wasn't one of the songs off the second EP, in Old Soul with New and Imagined Things. But yeah, so it wasn't one of those songs. But yeah, hoping you guys well, we'll check that out because I really want one of the songs to get placed. And in the meantime, give the song some streams. I mean, hopefully this bill gets passed in Congress and, you know, I'll earn a cent per stream on my songs instead of like half a cent, which is what I've been, which is everyone's been getting, the rate everyone's been getting for a while now. But yeah, so please go check that out. Link to that is in the text description of the episode of this podcast. And, you know, also check out the Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. I update those a lot. I decided to stick with a 2-a-month release schedule, you know, because, you know, just trying to figure out what song to do and getting caught up with podcast interviews. It's hard for me to do more than that, you know, plus my school schedule and other things as well. So I decided to stick with a 2-a-month release schedule. But yeah, so hopefully you guys will you know, are okay with that. But yeah, so please go check out the Spotify playlist where you can get an idea for the kind of music I talk about on my podcast. And if you have any suggestions or songs to talk about next time podcast, and have you, please email me at samlcwilliamicloud.com. You can also follow me, reach out to me on Instagram and TikTok at iHeartOldies. And yeah, guys, you know, also I should probably put the link to my music video too, but I can only fit certain amount of links for the text description to this episode of this podcast, unfortunately. So I'll try to fit my YouTube link for my last music video somewhere, but that was a fun music video. Hope to do more soon, but you never know. I mean, I'm not really sure if I want to do another music video at this point, but yeah. So I'm Sam Williams, and thank you guys for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next time, please keep things moving.